should the U.S. Senate vote to confirm or deny Judge Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court? Do you support or oppose Senate Democrats' plans to filibuster Gorsuch, and why? And do you think Republicans should use the so-called nuclear option to confirm Gorsuch? We'll explore these questions and more, and welcome yours as well for our guest expert. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We will talk about the confirmation process for Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch, and bring along the very latest, including an anti-Gorsuch talkathon that is taking place as we speak on the U.S. Senate floor. And again, welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest. Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. His areas of expertise include American politics and judicial process. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Well, we just heard in NPR News, and we didn't know this until just a few minutes ago, that Senator Jeff Merkley is holding the floor on the U.S. Senate floor. He had an overnight marathon speech going into this morning to protest Judge Neil Gorsuch's nomination to the Supreme Court. He is not a filibuster. It's headlined here a talkathon. What's your reaction to this?
A distinction without a difference, I guess. Under Senate rules, individuals in the Senate can hold the floor as long as they wish. And so I suppose it's in the eye of the beholder whether or not it's a talkathon or a filibuster, but it's an opportunity for every member of the Senate to sort of have their say on the issue of the day or the issue before the Senate. Apparently, he has some pent-up frustrations and wants to air grievances, and he's taking his opportunity to do it. I mean, when you get the floor and you have a lot to say, you often want to keep it for as long as possible. It doesn't just go for nominations like this, whether it's for an executive position or for a court. I mean, I remember Joe Biden doing it for a piece of federal criminal legislation in the 1990s, where he was the only person in the hall, and to keep attention on him and the absence of people in the Senate chamber, he walked up and down the aisle, so C-SPAN had to find him. This happens more than we think, and it often happens in the dark of night, and we're all asleep, so we don't tend to pay attention.
Yeah. So Senator Merkley is taking up the floor, but he's addressing plagiarism charges against the Supreme Court nominee. Do you know much about this, the plagiarism charge?
This is something that came up recently, and I haven't heard much about it. I think this is the drip that partisans often try to use to collapse these kinds of nominations, try to find one more element and one more thing. Again, I'm not sure about the veracity of these charges. I haven't delved into it all that much because, again, it is something rather new. And I'm not trying to make excuses for the judge, but these individuals write quite a bit, and they're often writing under certain time pressures. It doesn't excuse plagiarism. Things should always be cited. But sometimes things slip, especially when you're relying on clerks. And clerks are recent law school graduates or very advanced law school students who are working for the judges, and mistakes can be made. So I'm not sure whether or not this is something that is going to cause the downfall of this particular nomination.
All right. Well, so besides this talkathon that's going on, explain the process to us. What can we expect to happen over the next few days?
Well, part of this is a little political gamesmanship and some partisan wrangling. Senator Schumer has been very bold about making the claim against his Republican colleagues that this is not the right nomination. Now, I'm not sure whether or not the Democrats actually believe that, whether or not they are playing a game for future nominations, whether or not they're trying to gain some concessions regarding other nominations or potential legislation that's coming, because all of that could be part of this mix. You know, while certainly Judge Gorsuch has some political positions and some legal positions that would raise the ire of Democrats, he's not incompetent for the job. He's someone who is highly qualified and in normal circumstances would be confirmed. So I think what's going on with the Democrats is that they may try to filibuster here. They may try to stop the nomination altogether, but there is what's often called the the nuclear option, or the constitutional option is sort of the more precise name for it, where the filibuster rules, which actually come from debate rules that you find in Senate Rule Number 22, they allow an individual senator to talk as long as they want unless you can get something known as cloture. And cloture requires three-fifths of the members of the Senate to cut off debate, and that's 60 votes. If you don't have 60 votes, then those in the minority, those 40, can keep talking and talking and talking, what we often call talking a bill or talking a nomination to death. And what happens is the talking never really happens, because even the threat of a filibuster, the leader of the Senate will often pull whatever legislation or nomination is before the institution, because there's too much to do in the institution. You can't hold things up for days and days and days. So really, filibusters hardly ever happen. It's a threat of a filibuster. What the nuclear option allows the leader of the Senate to do is claim that whatever procedure or rule is being applied is subject to majority rule instead of the cloture rule. And this is something that came about early in the 20th century and reinforced in 1957. And as a result, when things just get gummed up so much and things have to move along, this is kind of like the nuclear bomb you can set off to upend the rules of the Senate. And when that happens, you can move forward without needing the requisite 60 votes.
So the floor debate began yesterday with Senate Republicans and Democrats exchanging some tough words about each other's tactics. And here is Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from yesterday's floor debate.
It should be unsettling to everyone that our colleagues across the aisle have brought the Senate to this new low. On the floor, Democrats say they'll launch a partisan filibuster against them, something Republicans have never done. No one in the Senate Republican Conference, no one, has ever voted to filibuster a Supreme Court nominee.
So this is a big deal, Charlie?
It is a big deal. This will forever change the dynamics of United States Supreme Court nominations. But here's the oddity. You know, he's making the claim that it's never happened, but it could happen, and there's reason to have the rule. I'm not sure whether or not the application of filibuster in this case would be the time to use that rule. So I think the majority leader has a point there. But what will happen is that it will just be normal majoritarian politics, which means that a president, if his party or her party were in power, that president could nominate whomever he or she wanted, and the majority party would validate that appointment. And so there wouldn't be that minority check on the possibility of having somebody who is woefully unqualified for the position. Now, would presidents do that, pick somebody who is woefully unqualified and not be checked by his or her own party? Unlikely, but this really is going to change the way that the Senate does business on these kinds of nominees.
Democrats were not amused with Mitch McConnell's remarks. Assistant Minority Leader Dick Durbin responded with the poem, "I Met a Man Who Wasn't There" by Hughes Mearns, or Mearns, I'm not sure. Let's take a listen to this.
When I was going up the stair, I met a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. I wish that man would go away. I thought about that poem when I listened to the Majority Leader's speech about how cooperative he has been when it comes to Supreme Court nominations. The name he forgot to mention was Merrick Garland.
Durbin went on to say that Garland, who, of course, was President Obama's pick to fill the seat of Antonin Scalia after he passed away last year, was the only Supreme Court nominee in history to be denied a hearing and a vote. Do Democrats make a good argument in filibustering by pointing to Merrick Garland, Charlie Jacobs?
On filibustering, one could argue no in the technical sense, because it never got that far. The argument from the Republicans was that because we were deep in an election year, the public would want us to wait and not vote on a nominee until after the election and we decided who the next president should be, because that's part of the calculus of casting a vote in any election for president. So he never even got a hearing. He never went before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was never questioned. He was in this sort of legal limbo, and the rules didn't apply to him in that kind of way. So, I mean, there is a point that Dick Durbin is making, and that's, I think, part of the frustration of the Democrats here is they didn't have their opportunity to seat an individual when they had a Democratic president. And so it's sort of a pseudo kind of filibuster. It was using the rules to the advantage by the majority party. So, yes, he has a point, but at the same time, it was not a true filibuster, what the Democrats are attempting right now.
Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He is talking with us about the debate over the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. So, do you support the Democrats and their plans to filibuster this nomination? 1-800-642-1234. Listening to the Ideas Network, I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Charlie Jacobs, an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College, talking with him about the U.S. Senate expected to vote this week on President Trump's pick for the U.S. Supreme Court. But Democrats have enough votes to filibuster the pick in an attempt to stop Gorsuch from sitting on the high court. But Republicans have threatened to use the so-called nuclear option to approve Gorsuch. We're talking about all the politics involved and what it means for the future of the Supreme Court. We wonder if you think the Democrats are justified in this filibuster, or do you think it's just payback for Republicans not giving a hearing to President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland? Do you think Gorsuch is not mainstream enough to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court? Do you think this process should be delayed until the investigation over possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign is completed? Some of the reasons why Democrats say they are going to filibuster this pick. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Before we go to the phones, Charlie, let's talk a little bit about what we learned on Monday, that Democrats did secure enough votes to filibuster Gorsuch's nomination. So, just so we're on the same page here, what exactly does that mean?
So what that means is that under Senate rules, if you have the requisite number of votes, you can debate an issue and hold the floor, and you won't have enough votes to move the question, that is, the actual thing you're going to vote on, whether or not this person is going to get the seat on the United States Supreme Court. So under Senate rules, a single individual can take the floor and filibuster, that is, talk a bill to death. Now, under Senate rules, you can call for something called cloture. And cloture means if you get 60 votes, three-fifths of the Senate, to vote to end debate. Once you end debate, you can move to a vote, and then simple majoritarian politics takes over. All you need is 51 votes, which the Republicans have. Well, the Republicans don't have enough votes to move the question to that point and to end debate. So it gums up all of the work of the Senate, and you cannot move to the absolute vote on whether or not this person will get the seat on the bench.
Democrats have to keep blabbing forever and ever and ever? Or, I mean, is there no end in sight to a filibuster?
Well, they could technically do that, and the majority leader could force them to do that. But if there is resolve, they technically could just keep blabbing. But the problem is it grinds the work of the Senate to an absolute halt. And, I mean, remember, there's work to do. There are budgets mm-hmm. to pass. There are other individuals to confirm who should be confirmed to positions. So you can't stop the work of the United States government because you have a bunch of recalcitrant people on one side of the aisle. What would eventually happen is the majority leader would say, we're done. We're moving this off of the business of the Senate right now. And in essence, with consultation with the president, would have to decide whether or not to pull the nomination altogether. And the president might have to find somebody else who is more acceptable to the Democrats.
Ah, I see. So Republicans are faced with that option or the nuclear option.
Correct.
Yeah. And the nuclear option, explain exactly what that means.
So what the nuclear option does is if there's this threat of the filibuster, you can't get around those rules. And so the majority leader's stuck, except this nuclear option, also called a constitutional option, allows the Senate majority leader to argue that the Constitution finds an issue with the application of this particular rule in the Senate. So the rule of unending debate, filibuster, and cloture. And if the majority leader rules that the Constitution prohibits its application here, they in essence void the rule for the nominations of Supreme Court justices, and they move to a simple majority vote. So basically, it pulls the rug out from under the Democrats who are trying to filibuster and says, "You don't need, we don't need 60 votes anymore. We just need 51 to pass this guy through." And that would change the dynamics of nominations and approvals of United States Supreme Court justices into the future.
And there's risk for the Democrats also in that by filibustering and perhaps triggering the nuclear option that... that means that they can't filibuster another Supreme Court nominee in the future.
That's correct, because it would become precedent, not legal precedent, but precedent of the rules of the Senate into the future. And there's a person who sits both in the House and the Senate, individuals who are called the parliamentarians. And so in the future, if the Democrats said, well, we want a filibuster, they'd say, no, the nuclear option was applied here, and so all they need is 51 votes. Now, remember, as soon as the Republicans pull that trigger, if they lose the majority and there's a Democratic president, it applies to them, too. So, you know, there's a risk-reward here that they have to worry about, because this will become the new, in essence, standing rule of the Senate.
Yeah. And in terms of the nominee, Neil Gorsuch, he is replacing Antonin Scalia, who passed away. This does not change the... the balance of power on the court. It's a conservative being replacing another conservative, right?
Correct. There are a whole bunch of different ways to measure the partisanship of individuals on the court, but the easiest one is to just look at the president that nominated an individual, and there will be more individuals on the court nominated by Republicans who tend to be more conservative in their legal views and their interpretation of the Constitution. So it'll be a 5-4 split.
Yeah, and down the road, Ruth Bader Ginsburg possibly could retire, and then the replacement, if that happens during President Trump's administration, that would shift the balance of power on the court, and the Democrats may not have the filibuster option if they filibuster this one.
And that's true, but it's sort of six of one, half dozen of another. Either the nuclear option happens now, or it happens on the next one, or the one after that. I mean, any time that a Democrat argues, or the Democratic Party argues that they're going to filibuster, the same speech McConnell made yesterday would be made. I mean, it's kind of, when do you want to force the Republicans to pull the trigger on the nuclear option? And I think their calculation was, why wait? We'll just do it now, because why save up our energy? We might have enough energy among progressives and Democrats to support us that we can put pressure on the Republicans to pull this nomination.
Okay, questions now for Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Your questions or views on this this confirmation process for Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. Nate in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I was going to mention two separate things, the first of which is that I would argue the power play, and it was done more of power, I suspect, than popular desire by the Republicans in the Senate, was done against a president who had been elected to a four-year term with all the responsibilities of that term, including appointments. The second...
And I'm sorry, Nate, I just want to make sure I'm understanding you. You're saying that the Republicans, by not giving Merrick Garland a hearing, President Obama's nominee, started it?
Yeah, I would say that they actually broke precedent, and now we have the precedent just continuing to drop.
Yeah, and we've heard some refer to what the Republicans did, not giving a hearing to Merrick Garland, as the so-called Joe Biden rule? Because sometime in the past, Joe Biden said that maybe a president in his final year of his final term should not be able to appoint a judge to the U.S. Supreme Court, Charlie Jacobs.
Yeah, but that was more musing than anything else.
Right. So so how serious was it that Republicans did not grant a hearing to President Obama's nominee?
Sort of in the culture of the Senate, it was pretty serious. I mean, we typically look to the Senate to be the more collegial, more august, more deliberative institution that tries to avoid rank partisanship. And I think to many Senate observers, that's what it looked like, because there was no really solid precedent. You could point to an instance here or an instance there regarding the way in which particular nominations were handled. But, I mean, different eras often dealt with these kinds of issues in different kinds of ways. And so there was no solid precedent. I think Nate is exactly right about that. The Republicans just made an argument, and because they had the majority, they were able to enforce it. Now, again, this is something that can come swinging back at them sometime in the future. But I think they were confident enough that they wanted to, you know, hold that seat in the hopes that maybe they would get a Trump presidency or a Republican presidency, that they were willing to take that gamble.
Mm-hmm. And Nate, what was your other point?
Thank you. The other point was that if you look at the current president, who was elected with the Electoral College but without a popular mandate, that leaves at least some arguments about the popularity of that decision. But in addition, he campaigned both on, in terms of issues, being strongly pro-life, which means he, in one way, with Garland or his nomination is fulfilling that promise, but at the same token, even if you consider that he outsourced his picking, said that he was going to work to fix Washington and drain the swamp there, and at least some indications are that his nominee to Supreme Court would actually work to further deepen the slippery or swampy financial dealings of political figures in Washington.
I'm not sure I followed that entirely, but a reaction, Charlie?
Well, I think what Nate is saying is that this is not as sort of an outsider candidate for the court, that this isn't somebody who is going to have a new vision for the interpretation of the Constitution or the application of the laws, especially if we're talking about trying to upend the power structure of Washington, D.C. or the federal government and giving power back to the people in things like campaign finance reform and issues like that. And Merrick Garland is kind of a very traditional pick in the sense that he went to a top law school. He clerked at the United States Supreme Court. He has worked in government and in the federal court system for ages. Other than being from the 10th Circuit Court rather than, say, the D.C. Circuit Court, he is about as insider swampy on the judicial side as you could possibly get. So I think that's the point Nate is making, and I would kind of concur with his decision. He is a very traditional, typical kind of swampy pick.
And just I heard, and I think you might have just misspoke. We have so many names out here. I think you said Merrick Garland, and you meant Neil Gorsuch.
I did mean Neil Gorsuch. I'm sorry.
No, it's, let's go to David in Kenosha next. Hi, David.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I think the Democrats, by filibustering this support Supreme Court nominee, I listen to a lot of debate on public radio, and they keep asking this judge his personal views. The law is the law, and he has to answer everything to the letter of the law. When you're a judge, especially in that capacity, I don't know why they kept hammering on him his personal views, because I personally know a judge myself that's been a family member, a friend of our family for years. Whatever your personal views are, those have to be set aside, and you run strictly by the letter of the law. And they kept asking him about abortion and transgender rights stuff. Your personal views, especially like within law enforcement, the law is the law.
And it seems to me that always happens, Charlie, that when there's a justice or a judge nominated for the court, everybody asks about personal views, and the candidate will always say, "Oh, that's not relevant," or "I'm not going to talk about that because the issue might come before me in court."
And David's right. I mean, when we talk about black letter law, what's on the page? The argument would be, well, you just apply what's on the page. You know, it criminal courts or in trial courts, it's somewhat easier because you have refined statutes and the application can be somewhat easy. Not always easy, but somewhat easy. When you get to the constitutional level, it can get really sticky. Remember, the Constitution is only about 7,000 words long, and we're talking about language from the 18th century, and it can get a little confusing. When Congress, you know, when the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, does that really mean no law ever? That's the interpretive process. That's when an individual on the court, his or her personal views might shade the interpretation of the Constitution. I mean, we've had individuals like Justice Black who literally says no law means no law. Well, that's incredibly constraining for Congress. How do they do that? And others have said, well, sometimes you can restrict speech and sometimes you can't. Why does that happen? The personal views of justices.
Yeah, and during the campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump was promising that he was going to appoint a pro-gun and anti-abortion candidates to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And he, I think maybe Neil was making this point. I mean, he's holding to his campaign promises. And Neil was suggesting that, well, you know, he sort of let surrogates make these choices for him. All presidents do that, but his surrogates basically followed the template that Trump created. I want this kind of conservative justice who is going to read the Constitution strictly.
Yeah. David was also going to make the point that we need 9 justices and the Senate should confirm Neil Gorsuch because he's qualified and a good judge and the Supreme Court needs him. A reaction to that.
I would agree. If you look at the court's docket for this year, and the docket is just the list of cases that they select, it is completely devoid of cases that need resolution on important constitutional issues. And part of the reason is if you tie 4-4 at the Supreme Court, the holding of the lower court is controlling. And that's problematic because you don't get the high court to speak.
Yeah. How important is Neil Gorsuch being confirmed to President Trump in his presidency?
I think it's important because it's a win. I mean, I think that the chattering classes in the media and pundits and the like have been hammering Trump because he hasn't really had a big win yet. Mm-hmm. Stumbled a bit trying to repeal Obamacare, has been struggling to get positions filled at the federal level. And he's been a little slow out of the gate with the tax reform proposals that he suggested he was going to make. This, I think, would be something signature for him to say, we did it. We got this individual on. There'll be a well-televised ceremony confirming him to the bench. And then the business of the court will start in earnest again. And so I think this is important for him to be able to hang his hat on as a win for his presidency.
We are talking with Charlie Jacobs, an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere, whose areas of expertise include American politics and judicial process. And we are talking about the confirmation process and the debate going on over the President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch. Democrats have enough votes to filibuster, and Republicans are threatening to pull the so-called nuclear option. What do you think of all this, and what do you want to see happen? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. The Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the politics of U.S. Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. The U.S. Senate is expected to vote this week on whether or not to confirm Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. We are talking about the the predicted Democratic filibuster and the Republicans' likely use of the nuclear option. And we're wondering what you think of all this. Do you support the Democrats in trying to block this nomination, or do you think they're wrong? Do you think that Neil Gorsuch is qualified to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court and Democrats should let it be, or what? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. We are talking with Charlie Jacobs, an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College. Here's an email from Matt in Wausau. He writes, Barack Obama won by almost 10 million votes in 2008 and 5 million votes in 2012. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by almost 2.9 million votes. By gaming the system, Republicans have denied the will of the people. If Americans just wanted Republican leaders to have their choice of a Supreme Court justice, they would have voted accordingly. Gorsuch is no more qualified than Merrick Garland, and Garland didn't even get a hearing. I commend Democrats for standing up and fighting, although, once again, it's a day late and a dime short. Meanwhile, Travis on Facebook sarcastically says, yes, please filibuster. That will be the final nail in the coffin for Democrats in 2018 and 2020. A reaction, Charlie.
I mean, I think that Matt is correct that the system was gamed, but the system can be gamed. That's a political choice that the Republicans made. I mean, I think what they would argue is well, even if you indict us for gaming the system, we didn't lose control of either chamber of Congress, and you can argue there are whole bunches of reasons for that, and that we won the presidency. So, and even if we did it without the majority vote, we did what we had to do to win. So gaming the system was obviously the preferred option for the public. I mean, I'm sort of making that argument just as a devil's advocate kind of thing, because I think that there are norms that have to be followed, and there might have been a little pushing of those norms by the Republicans in certain ways. Democrats do it too to gain advantage when they can. And to Travis's point, I think that the political calculations of the public in a midterm election are going to go a lot deeper than merely this one choice by the Democrats. While it may affect them, I think the overall, what we've tended to see in history is this, people are voting in midterms based upon the record of the president, and that's why often presidents lose some, if not many, seats in the House and the Senate based upon their performance for the first 2 years.
Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson has not said whether he supports his party using the nuclear option, but in a statement that he put out late on Monday, he said, the voters in my state of Wisconsin spoke. They voted their 10 electoral votes in support of President Trump, and they voted to elect me to confirm President Trump's nominee to this Supreme Court vacancy. Your reaction to Senator Johnson's reasons for supporting Gorsuch?
It's a very populist position. He's trying to reflect what he perceives to be the will of the public on this particular issue. I don't think necessarily just the fact that he won means that he should reflexively vote for the president's choice. I think there has to be some analysis of each individual nominee to see whether or not they are appropriate for the position. And it may be that even though they voted in Johnson, they may have voted him in for a particular reason or a market basket of reasons, but a critical analysis of the nominees was expected, and maybe this isn't the right one. So I understand his point, but at the same time, I think that's a somewhat simplistic calculus.
Johnson also urged his Democratic counterpart, Tammy Baldwin, to not join the filibuster. Baldwin is listed as one of the 43 senators who plan to filibuster. Yesterday, Governor Scott Walker called out Tammy Baldwin as well on Twitter for her intention to filibuster. Walker said she broke her word to Wisconsinites to give Gorsuch a fair shot. Tammy Baldwin did not respond to Walker's repeated tweets. First off, your reaction to that, Governor Walker, calling out Tammy Baldwin on Twitter.
Well, I suppose to a certain extent, I'm sort of playing off of Johnson's argument, I guess, a little bit more here than the governor's, but it's interesting that, you know, that what's good for Johnson, that is, he was voted in by the public, and so he's going to listen to them because he would, you know, he's expected to vote for the president's nominees, doesn't hold for Tammy Baldwin as well. So it's sort of an interesting position to take. And I think that the governor, I think Tammy Baldwin might make the argument as I gave him a fair hearing, and my assessment is he's not appropriate for the position. So it depends on how you define fair hearing, I suppose.
How do you expect this filibuster to go over with the public?
I suspect that the public will side, generally speaking, with the Republicans. I think that there are going to be partisans on the left who make that Merrick Garland argument that they stymied an appropriate nominee to the court. But I think most of the public would make the assessment, well, that's in the past, and Trump was elected, and he has this constitutional responsibility. And this is just sort of a technicality being used by Democrats in the Senate. It's a quirk of the rules, and they should allow the president to have his choice.
Gordon in Wisconsin Rapids is with us now. Hi, Gordon.
Hey, good morning. Great show, as always. I think it's played out perfectly. I didn't think a lame duck President Obama should have appointed, filled that seat. And I certainly didn't want Hillary Clinton to fill that seat. So I'm very, very glad that Trump has that opportunity to fill his constitutional right to go ahead and get his guy on there. And he should do it quickly.
Yeah. So what do you think about the Democrats filibustering it and the Republicans possibly pulling the nuclear option, Gordon?
I think it's great. Yeah, I think the Democrats are a bunch of weenies. Just go ahead and win an election and have your way. But they didn't win. So let Trump go ahead and do it. Put him in.
I've never asked this of a guest before, Charlie, but are the Democrats a bunch of weenies?
That's got to be a Republican campaign slogan in 2 years. I want to see that on lawn signs. Yes and no. Again, this is as unprecedented as it was to not give Merrick Garland the hearing, because you know, McConnell is correct in the sense that they've always sort of rubbed up against the idea that, oh, we'll filibuster a nominee to the court. But generally speaking, cooler heads have prevailed and some sort of concessions were made, or they backed away from the water's edge. I think one of the issues that I might take issue with Gordon is the idea of lame duck President Obama. I mean, technically speaking, he was lame duck the first day of his second term in office. Does that mean he's precluded from making these kinds of nominations, and not just to the Supreme Court, but to lower courts as well? And that's the sticky argument. And, of course, the Republicans were persuasive to say it's the last year, so that's lame duck enough. And I think this is why Democrats are being weenies, is because they really didn't see that as a plausible argument. And their line in the sand now is with this nomination with Gorsuch.
You know, the Democrats have stated a lot of different reasons why they're planning on filibustering. The Merrick Garland being ignored was one of them. Another is that they don't think that Gorsuch is a mainstream candidate or nominee. But there's also been talk that while President Trump and his campaign remain under FBI investigation into whether or not there was collusion with the Russians during the presidential campaign and election, that this process should not go forward. What do you make of that argument?
Untenable, maybe. I mean, that's a causal chain of potential events that's so long that I'm not sure exactly where it ends. So he's under investigation, which means more hearings, which maybe means impeachment or removal proceedings. I mean, I'm not exactly sure where the Democrats think that begins and ends. And quite honestly, then don't you extend that same argument to all his nominees as well as legislation? It seems a little bit odd, and I think one of the weakest arguments that the Democrats probably have.
David in Verroqua was with us. Hello, David.
Hi. You know, for all the Republicans talk of, like, sticking with and following the Constitution, they have such a very pro-business nominee like Gorsuch, not to mention their attacks on environment and health care. I mean, whatever happened to promote the general welfare with these guys?
All right. Well, what happened to that, Charlie?
Well, the interpretive process, I guess. I mean, it depends on how you're reading the Constitution. Gorsuch is considered a textualist, which means he tries to apply very narrow definitions of what the words mean in statute and in the Constitution. And when you do that, it often gives lots of flexibility to the people to exercise their rights, as well as Congress and state legislatures to write laws, because they're not going to be constrained by the Constitution. Liberals and Democrats in courts tend to read much more broadly, which constricts the ability of governments to exercise power. So I think that they would suggest that they're not being very hypocritical at all. This is exactly the way it's supposed to work, liberty for all, and the people will make their choices at the ballot box about how government should exercise authority.
So in our final minute or so, what's the most likely scenario here? What do you expect over the next few days?
I suspect that the Democrats may back down from their pursuit of the filibuster. I'm not sure whether or not they actually want to throw themselves on this hand grenade at this point and change the Senate rules the way that this will occur. And remember, this won't eradicate the filibuster completely, only in this narrow way, but it's still that slippery slope. And I think that they might understand that they could do damage to the idea of the filibuster and the role of the Senate in discussing legislation if they do this. So I think that they might get a little twitchy at the end and maybe not go all the way and dive into the deep end of the pool.
Very interesting. And we have just, again, less than a minute to go. Should, though, the Democrats filibuster, you have no doubt that the Republicans would pull that nuclear option trigger?
I think they do, and I think it's not just because it's not just because they want this person. I think it's about a political calculation to make sure that Trump gets a win, that they seem to be moving on with their agenda, and that they can start to pick up other things that they really want to do as the majority controlling party.
Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Thanks to producers Bill Martins and Brianne Chasso. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.